terms of the weather. And I certainly want to thank all the people at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston who've done such hard work putting this conference together. This conference tries to bring together policymakers, academics, business leaders to talk about policy issues that are relevant and important. And I think this year we certainly hit it right. As everybody knows, Congress is in the midst of a very active discussion about how we're going to regulate financial institutions, how we can avoid the types of crises that we've been encountering over the last 2 years. And so I think the discussion over the next 2 days is going to help us think about what are the types of issues we should be focused on and hopefully what are some of the solutions that we should be looking at. In terms of an overview of this conference, I don't think anybody needs to have very many details about what's happened over the last 2 years. We've all lived the last 2 years. I would say if we were in this room 3 years ago with the exact same topic for the conference, that I don't think anybody could have anticipated the type of extraordinary measures that were taken over the last 2 years. Certainly, I don't think anybody would have anticipated that there would be the kind of investment of taxpayer dollars that occurred not only for depository institutions, but also for non-depository institutions. And I don't think anybody thought that the regulatory safety net was going to be extended nearly as far as it was. So it includes mutual funds, it included investment banks, it included the securitization market, it included the commercial paper market. Those are all things that I don't think 3 years ago we could have possibly anticipated would be necessary. In addition, it's not just in the United States where these problems were faced. It really was a global problem. So while the match was struck in the United States, I would say that the fire was actually a global fire. And I think that's a bit of a surprise as well, how quickly financial problems in the United States could spill over into a global context. I've spent much of my research life studying how financial problems spill over to the real economy, and now it seems like a lot more people are listening. That clearly I think we've seen some evidence of how financial problems can create real problems for the overall economy. I think one of the most surprising facts that occurred as this crisis unfolded was how quickly liquid financial markets could seize. So financial markets where you could make very large transactions without moving price became markets where you could do virtually no transactions, where the bid-ask spread got very wide, where it was virtually impossible to find a counterparty willing to trade with you, in many markets that previously had been both deep and highly liquid. The financial problems quickly extended to the real economy. As everybody knows, we're in the process of trying to recover from a deep and protracted recession. It's not a recession that only occurred in the United States. It's a global recession, and I think one of the more striking details of this recession is how much it's affected global trade. There's been an active response, and I think one of the pleasant surprises over this crisis has been the similarity in responses worldwide. They differ in details, but in the general context of what was done, I think many countries did very similar activities. Central banks in many parts of the world lowered the interest rates that they target to close to zero. And deficits in almost every country that was affected by the crisis had their deficits swell as they followed expansionary fiscal policy. Fortunately, the financial firestorm was contained by, I think, the extraordinary measures taken by both the monetary and fiscal authorities, both here and abroad. There are a number of questions I think we want to try to address in this conference. Was this crisis preventable? Could it have been better contained? What are the implications for government structures? What are the implications for government policies? And what are the implications for the global economy? Hopefully it won't only be questions, but hopefully also some answers that we get from both the paper givers, the discussants, and hopefully there'll be an active discussion from the floor as well. We've actually had an hour and a half at each of these sessions, so there'd be plenty of time for interaction with the audience. So I would hope that as we go through the next 2 days, there are plenty of questions that come from the floor. Now, I'm going to take a brief digression that hopefully gives an analogy that I hope everybody finds this apt. We, after all, are in New England, and New England is a historic region of the country. And so I want to go back to a little bit of history, actually from Boston. And that's the lesson from the second great fire in Boston. It occurred in 1872. It burned down most of the downtown area. Actually, the site isn't that far from where the Federal Reserve building now stands. Over 700 buildings were burned. There was substantial loss of life. Many employers had to close down. Many insurers were unable to meet their obligations. It was a devastating impact on the city of Boston. What's interesting about the Great Fire was this was not an isolated case. There were great fires in many cities across the United States. Probably most striking is that it was the second Great Fire in Boston, so obviously we didn't completely learn from our mistakes from the first Great Fire in Boston. Also, there were many fires that were occurring around other major cities. Now, I'm not a historian, and this isn't a comprehensive list, but most of these events actually were quite tragic events in each of these cities. It actually did lead to very different impacts on each of these cities. But it did highlight that it was a continuing problem around the country. Now, a second thing that is worth noting is the dates. The dates on these great fires are mostly from the 1800s and very early 1900s. And it's not that we've stopped all fires, but we've stopped fires that created catastrophe for cities. So what I want to ask is, we've gone through a financial firestorm. Are there any lessons to learn from what we've done to prevent great fires in cities that provide lessons for how we can avoid great fires in our financial system? So what are the conditions that create great fires in cities? Well, one, dangerous conditions occur if they're flammable buildings. Frequently, buildings were made of wood. In Boston, many of the buildings were not made of wood, but the roofs were. So wood roofs were a problem because embers would go from roof to roof, causing a fire in each of the buildings. In addition, there were a variety of dangerous business practices that might not have been anticipated. For example, you were not taxed on inventory if the inventory was kept in the attic of your building. As a result, all your flammable equipment and inventory were located right underneath the wooden roof, which made perfect conditions for a fire to spread. There were inadequate mitigants. Fire departments were inadequately equipped. In Boston, they had started building taller buildings, but the water couldn't be reached from the fire hydrants and the type of equipment they were using. And in fact, the fire hydrants weren't even standardized. So when the equipment went up to the fire hydrant, sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't if you had to move fire equipment around the city. Water supply was problematic. It was a very antiquated system, and as a result, water pressure was a problem. And finally, there was completely insufficient enforcement of the fire code. Finally, I would add a little note from a fiction by this title, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Almost every great city fire has a series of unfortunate events. Some of them are caused by natural problems of wind and weather, dry conditions. But in Boston, oddly enough, the thing that caused a particular problem was that the fire horses had the flu. As a result, they had to take equipment pushed by people rather than horses. So very unusual events. Frequently, when we have catastrophes, it is a series of unfortunate events. That's what makes the unexpected happen. So why are great city fires no longer occurring? Well, cities took fire prevention seriously. When the city of Boston burned down, we didn't rebuild it exactly the way it had been before. Streets were laid out so that they were much wider streets. Building materials were improved, so wood really wasn't used on roofs or in other parts of the building. And there was strict enforcement of the fire code. In addition, there were improved tools that were able to be used by fire departments. Fire departments became professionalized, and fire equipment was improved. So we went from this to this, a very dramatic change, and an environment in which a lot more people can live in downtowns without concerns about the kind of great fires. Now, it's not that we don't have fires. We've had fire alarms at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, but they're contained. They're contained in a way that, fortunately, we haven't had a problem in the building, and fortunately, none of the buildings in the area have caused a problem for our building, so that we don't have the kind of contagion that frequently plagued cities in the past. So what should we take from the experience of these great fires to think about the future of financial firestorms. And I would just highlight a few that I hope we're going to discuss over the course of the next 2 days. In terms of improving mitigants, high on my list of things that I think is very important for Congress to try to do is to get resolution authority for systemic institutions. We need an ability to contain systemically important institutions so that even if a fire breaks out in that institution, it doesn't become a fire that affects everybody else. We also ideally would have a central bank that didn't have to be involved with resolution procedures for individual organizations. Part of the reason why the Federal Reserve had to be involved in organizations we didn't want to be involved in was because there was no resolution authority. Nobody had the responsibility to actually do something. Not only should we find ways to resolve institutions, but I think it will be interesting to hear people's views on how institutions could more easily be resolved if we take some preventive actions. One suggestion that's been made by some, including some in this room, are the idea of living wills, that organizations as part of the supervisory process would be required to talk about how they could be resolved in the event that they do have financial difficulties. Now, I was talking to Don Cohn on the ride down, and he highlighted that the incentives might not be right, that while I might want to get my living will right, it's not so clear that an organization wants to get its living will right. There might be some incentive issues with that. But nonetheless, I think it would be a very useful exercise, and I certainly think that supervisors would learn a great deal from understanding what parts of large systemic institutions were really parts of the institution that couldn't easily be resolved. As part of the supervisory process, one thing that we should give greater thought to is simpler structures. When you look at a holding company structure for a major global bank, some are very simple, some are extremely convoluted. Many times it's a result of tax advantages or other types of advantages that may make perfect sense from an organizational structure for the organization, but certainly don't make sense if what we're trying to do is resolve the institution if it does have financial problems and resolve it in a way that doesn't affect other organizations. In addition, just like firemen now have much better tools, I think we need to improve the toolkit for the bank supervisors. A number of people in this room have argued that convertible debt, so that debt could be converted to equity if an institution gets into difficulty, so there are triggers that converted automatically to equity, would be a good idea. I agree with those people. I think actually this is an idea that's at least worth thinking about more carefully and possibly pursuing. One of the things that we've learned is that not only do we want to prevent institutions from failing, but we actually want to prevent them from getting so undercapitalized that they shrink their assets. One of the reasons we care about financial institutions is because they're providing liquidity, because they're providing loans, because they're financing the businesses in our country that we want to have financed. So what we want to do is we want to contain capital during difficult times. One way of doing that would be to have earlier suspension of dividends. Many of the large institutions that ended up needing TARP money were institutions that earlier in the crisis actually had issued dividends. A number of people in this room, as well as organizations, have argued that we should be thinking about higher capital requirements for systemically important institutions, and in addition, arguing that possibly we should have larger reserves. Reserves that are built up during the good times, not reserves that are built up during the bad times, to try to deal with some of the cyclicality issues with the current procedures that we're employing. And finally, greater liquidity. We've learned that there can be runs not only on banks, but on financial intermediaries more generally. Money market funds, private equity firms, hedge funds, any organization that has short-term assets or short-term liabilities and long-term assets runs the risk that debt holders or depositors are going to want their funds much more quickly and particularly during a period of financial difficulty, which will make it very difficult for that organization to liquidate their positions without large financial loss. Finally, I would argue that we do need to have much more focus on systemic risk more generally. Mandates do matter. Our central bank is different because it has a dual mandate rather than a single mandate. No one has the mandate for focusing on systemic risk. to the extent that we expect organizations to be worried about systemic risk and to do something about systemic risk, I think it should be mandated for those organizations. I think those organizations, as a result, would provide much more focus on early identification of problems and also think about creative ways to try to avoid the problems in the first place. And finally, I would highlight the comprehensive oversight. There are major gaps that allowed risks to occur in our economy. Some of those risks were in the banking system, but many of those risks were outside of the banking system. So we need to do a better job of identifying those risks and finding ways to make sure that they don't cause a more general problem. If we see a situation where there's large asset growth financed by leverage, we should be starting to ask questions about what happens if the downside actually occurs. Who will be impacted? What will be the reaction of others? Will we be able to contain the fire? So hopefully these introductory remarks will give us some food for thought as we go through the series of papers. I think we have a very exciting list of paper givers and discussants. I'm very much looking forward to the discussion, and hopefully we'll have a continuing of the nice weather over the next 2 days. So welcome to the conference, and I look forward to the first session.